major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we visit with some very diverse and fascinating characters. New Yorker Don Lee exchanged a life in computer science for the bartender's life, ultimately creating cocktail programs for David Chang, Wiley Dufresne, and other culinary big wheels of the Big Apple. You'll love the taste explorations Don takes us on. Then, culinary historian Michael Twitty's life is simply one big exploration. We'll travel along with Michael on his recent Southern Discomfort Tour. And Dr. Gourmet is back with some fresh ideas for a healthy new attitude. All that and more on this week's Louisiana Eats. Several years ago, New Yorker Don Lee made a life-changing move from computer science to cocktail science. Don served as opening beverage director for the famed New York speakeasy, PDT, and created the cocktail program at David Chang's Momofuku Sambar. Although he's been described as a cocktail genius, Don describes himself as simply a bartender. Bartending is actually a second career for you because you started off working in IT. So where was that and how'd you make that change?
Went to school, studied computer science, actually mostly studied photography, and got a job working for a finance company doing IT. Figured, you know, this way I could pay to afford to live in New York City. And I was living with my college girlfriend for a couple of years, and she decided to go to grad school, moved away, and we broke up, and I had a lot of free time on my hands. And it was one of those things where, you know, it's not like I was sad and trying to drown my sorrows, but New York was an exciting place to be a single guy, you know, in his mid-20s with disposable income. So I was going out to restaurants, and I was seeing what was happening in the culinary scene. David Chang was just, you know, opening a Momofuku noodle bar. Wiley was killing things at WD50 and really showing, you know, New York what you could do with the whole avant-garde food movement. And it was just really exciting to see all those restaurants open. And at the same time, I had that aha moment that people have with food, but with cocktails, where I'm, oh my God, why is this so good? And why have I never had a great cocktail before? And that bar was Pegu Club.
Uh-huh.
Little did I know that Pegu Club would then go on to create all these great bartenders, and those bartenders would then go on to open all their bars. But I was one of their early regulars. I was the guy that came at 6 o'clock, sat at the bar and just tried all the drinks. And once I tried all the drinks, I became the guinea pig. So all the bartenders tried their new recipes on me, tried all the weird historical recipes on me. And so I got a unique education that you can't possibly buy, in that I learned the palate of the 5, 6, 7 great bartenders today as they were developing their own palates.
That's fascinating. So what happened next? How did you make the jump from in front of the bar to behind the bar?
So I was having parties at home because I had to spread the liver damage because I couldn't consume all the cocktails myself. So I was making cocktails for my friends. And these bartenders who became my friends, they said, hey, you know how to make all these cocktails now. You know, you clearly have a decent palate. Why don't you get behind the bar? And it was kind of a selfish thing because Death & Company had just opened and they were a little short-staffed and they wanted to take some breaks. They wanted to take a couple of days off, but they didn't have enough people to cover. So myself and one of the other apprentice leaders here at Tales of the Cocktail, John Darragon, we were both those regulars. They said, hey, you guys, pick up a couple shifts so we can go on vacation. And they trained us. I worked one shift behind that bar and PDT opened. And Jim Meehan said, hey, you know, I heard you got trained at Death & Company. Do you want to pick up a regular shift here? And, you know, the rest is history.
Well, of course, PDT is that famous New York speakeasy. The PDT stands for Please Don't Tell. Tell us about PDT.
Well, PDT is an interesting thing. It first opened not intending to be a cocktail bar. It opened because the owner of Criff Dogs, which is a kind of a college student deep-fried hot dog place, had a liquor license and acquired the space next to the hot dog restaurant. And he wanted to open a bar, but he couldn't have a second entrance that was separate from his main hot dog place. Otherwise, he'd need a separate liquor license. So he punched a hole through the wall, and he put this phone booth up and created this faux speakeasy. Not thinking that it would be part of the craft cocktail movement.
Well, walk us through that experience of how the customer is able to enter from the hot dog stand, basically, into the bar.
Sure. As you walk down St. Mark Street, which is one of the, it's just a really young, vibrant, lots of college NYU kids, a lot of really interesting East Village artist types, you get to this giant sign that says, Eat Me, and it's a big hot dog with a woman straddling it. So you walk down the steps, and you walk past these video game machines, you know, old Pac-Man and, you know, Spy Hunter, and on the left, there's a phone booth. No sign, nothing, just a phone inside. You open the phone booth, pick up the phone, dial a number, no secret number, just any number, and a hostess will open the wall behind you, and you walk inside, and it's this tiny little speakeasy bar. So 12 seats at the bar, you know, we can fit probably about 50 if we really pack it in, but we don't let people stand, so it's just a really intimate space.
And you have to make, like, a reservation to get in? Wasn't that part of the process?
Right. We tried to make it really fair, so reservations, same day, no crazy advance notice, 3 p.m., make the call, and we'll take your reservation. But there's no reservation for the bar, so there's always a chance that you could get a seat at the bar.
Oh, that is so cool. So you're at the bar then, and let's talk about the cocktails that you're serving. Some of them, as I understand, were inspired by famous chefs like David Chang and Wiley Dufresne.
So the cocktails, especially in those early years, part of it was that we didn't really have any supervision. Jim Meehan was still the head bartender at Gramercy Tavern and hadn't really come on full-time at PDT yet. And we, with myself and this guy, John Darragon again, we were these two guys who were customers, never worked in a bar before, suddenly bartending. And no one told us, hey, you shouldn't do that. You know, no one told us that that's a bad idea, or this is, you know, that's not something that the customer's interested in, or no one's ever done that, you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. So all we knew was there's all this interesting things happening out in the food world in New York, and we wanted to do that behind the bar. So one of the cocktails I made, I went to WD-50 one day, and Wiley had made a popcorn soup. And it's, you know, you deconstruct popcorn, you turn it into soup, you know, the texture is all different, but the flavor is all there. And when you have popcorn, it's such a loaded food. You associate it with movie theaters and with carnivals. You know, it's something you might have at home, but it's not very often you have at home. And when you do, it's kind of special. So it has this nostalgia to it. And so I was wondering, how do I take popcorn and put that into a cocktail? So what I ended up doing was using this technique called fat washing, which takes the flavor of fat and pulls it into alcohol to pull butter into rum and then put dry air popcorn into that same rum. So I would have popcorn and butter and rum in one. If you imagine, it's kind of this Venn diagram of flavors that come together that you associate. So you have, you know, popcorn and Coke, which is going to the movie theater, and you have popcorn with butter, you know, buttered popcorn. You have butter and rum, you know, hot buttered rum, and you have rum and Coke. So there's all these things that naturally fit together, and then when you have it, everyone says, oh, it's like going to the movie theater. And so whether, you know, you have that great memory of going to the movie theater with your father or mother, or, you know, that first date you had, you know, your first love, it's such an emotional thing. And to be able to draw on people's emotions as they have that sip is a really fun thing to do.
That evocative taste memory, there's nothing like it, is there?
Exactly.
Now, I read recently in Bon Appetit that you had predicted the next big thing is going to be nitrogen infusion. Can you tell me about what that is?
Nitrogen infusion is a really interesting technique, especially, you know, because there's so many people that are playing with infusions right now, and this just changes the game and what's possible with it. It is you use what's called an EC canister, ISI.
Yes.
Usually people use it for making whipped cream. A lot of chefs use it. What you do is you put alcohol into it, and then you put something that you want to extract flavor from. So something, usually plant matter, something that is a little bit porous. So let's say either fresh herbs or something like coffee or cocoa nibs. And normally what you do is you just let it sit and wait. Now what you do with the ISI container is you can charge it with nitrogen. And when you charge it with nitrogen, the nitrogen dissolves into the alcohol. And when you charge it a second time, that excess pressure forces the alcohol inside the cell walls of the plant. And then when you vent it and open it up, it comes boiling out. Just like making soda water, you carbonate the water, and if you were to open soda water on a hot day, it would boil out. And when it does, it comes boiling out of the plant, and it brings out all that flavor really quickly.
Give me an example of how you use that.
So let's say cocoa nibs, for example. If I wanted to make a cocoa infusion into alcohol, if I were to put, let's say, vodka and cocoa nibs in a jar and let it sit, it would take a week, 2 weeks, depending on the temperature, depending on the strength of the alcohol and the flavor of the cocoa, to extract some flavor out of that. But what you would extract is not only the cocoa flavor, but some of the bitterness. You know, and we all know that chocolate is fairly bitter. Mm-hmm. What you can do with the nitrous infusion is that you charge it and you vent it and you strain it off. And that's a 10-minute process there, start to finish. And you get only the top notes. Because it didn't have to sit there for a long time, you don't get all those bitter characteristics. Mm. So you get that beautiful chocolate aroma, but you don't get that bitterness in the mouth.
Delicious. Well, speaking of nitrogen, I understand that you are occasionally giving lectures on sensory neuroscience in cocktails. What's that about?
Well, it sounds really complicated, but it's not really. It's one of those things where, you know, we don't really think about these things in everyday life. When we make coffee in the morning, you know, you're probably groggy and you're like, oh, I just need to wake up and get to work. We don't wake up and say, oh, I'm going to make an infusion today and I'm going to add this much liquid to this much solid and, you know, I'm going to extract all these particles. But we do it every day. And it's just taking the actions we do every day and, you know, applying a little bit of science to it to figure out why it works that way and then to figure out how it is as people we experience those things. Because, you know, I can use a, you know, machine to tell me how many parts per million might be in something, but I can't tell you, you know, if you think it smells like chocolate or if you think it smells like vanilla. You need a person to do that. And so it's how, as a science, do you use people as the tool to measure the intensity of flavor and whether something exists or doesn't exist from a human experiential perspective.
You know, you really are kind of like a little bit of a mad scientist. And I have to admit, I find this all so thrilling. And I saw a tweet from you. Mm-hmm. And this is what it said. All real mixologists know that the best ice is harvested by NASA robots from the prime numbered moons of Neptune according to the orbital period. Now, I guess this speaks to how important ice is to you. And what was that tweet all about?
Well, that was actually me making fun of the community, obviously. Big ice is one of those things that it's kind of it's a question of sign and signifier. Like, is it the thing that, you know, that shows that you're really doing it, or does it really mean that you're doing good drinks? And I feel that people get caught up in the things that people can see and not necessarily in the reasons why something tastes good to a customer. And they get caught up in the paraphernalia and not in the service of things. So big ice, when you think about it historically, people didn't have refrigerators. You had an ice box. Mm-hmm. And before that, you didn't have ice at all unless it was winter, in which case when the lake froze over, you harvested a big piece of ice. So people originally only had big ice. They had this big block of ice in a cooler, or they had this winter frozen lake ice. And you would use an ice pick and you would, you know, cut off pieces. And if you were going to make a cold drink, that's the big ice you would use. So the fact that we all have small ice now is kind of the more modern thing. And mm-hmm. So we're not making big ice as the new modern advancement. We're kind of really looking back at what used to be. But ice it's important, and I can talk for hours about ice. But at the end of the day, it's like a garnish. It's something that looks really great to a customer. And the customer, you know, might enjoy a really beautiful flower in that drink. But having a bartender that smiles at you, that listens to what you want to drink and makes you something nice and takes care of you is much more important than, you know, how clear your ice is or how big it is or if it came from a glacier or if you can get it from outer space.
Well, finally, I've read that you don't like the term mixologist, you know, that big term that's bandied about. And you keep referring to yourself as a bartender, so explain what that's all about.
Well, I actually feel a little guilty even calling myself a bartender anymore because I'm not actively behind the bar. I'm a retired bartender, not quite retired, bar professional. I don't really know what to call myself yet. But the term mixologist, I don't really have a problem with the term itself. It is a historical term. It was used tongue-in-cheek and seriously in the past. And it was kind of brought back by Dale DeGroff, who's kind of the godfather of cocktails in this modern age. He's the guy that brought back fresh juice at the Rainbow Room going back to 1987. So he brought it back because he wanted to be able to just tell people, hey, this isn't just average bartending. I'm doing something different, and I'm, you know, you want to see what this is. And it made sense at the time. But now you have these people that are more interested in, you know, calling themselves a mixologist and wearing vests and, you know, having curly mustaches than, again, taking care of their customers. So I don't think we need another term. I don't need to be something different and special. I just want to be really good at bartending. You know, I want to be a good bartender, not a different, special, other category.
And what's your favorite drink right now, and how do you make it?
Oh, that's a tough one. My favorite drink is usually the one that's in front of me at the moment.
I see.
But as cocktails go, I do love the old-fashioned. It's the old-fashioned because it's short for old-fashioned cocktail. And, you know, that's where the word cocktail comes from. And it's this deeply American cocktail, this the deeply American tradition. To me, it's like a haiku. When you have a really limiting form because you only have 5 ingredients and it's mostly base spirit with a little bit of bitters, a little bit of sugar and water, it's really difficult to do too much to it. But if you can work within that form, you can do really amazing things. And perhaps, you know, like a haiku, it becomes poetry.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us. I know you're busy, 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 so we'll let you get back to all that wild work you're up to. So thank you.
Thank you.
Bartender Don Lee. When we come back from a short break, we'll take a road trip with culinary historian Michael Twitty on what he calls the Southern Discomfort Tour. Buckle your seatbelt and stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Do you prefer your eggs stuffed or deviled? When researching 19th century recipes for my Madame Begay project, I discovered that Madame referred to her eggs as stuffed. A deviled egg usually indicates spicy mustard is in the stuffing. Even something as simple as a stuffed egg held a whole new cooking lesson for me when translating Madame Begay's original recipes. First, I'd never used butter as a binding before in a stuffed or deviled egg, only mayonnaise. Of course, in the time before refrigeration, mayonnaise would rapidly spoil and could become a deadly component in a dish. If your eggs are going to sit out on a buffet or be served at an outdoor event, maintaining a food-safe temperature is still an issue, even for 21st century cooks. That makes butter a superior choice over mayonnaise, and oh my goodness, the wicked deliciousness that butter adds. My favorite eggs are devilish, I must admit. I mash together boiled egg yolks with softened butter, a little Creole mustard, a tiny bit of minced green onion, and some very finely diced bits of tasso or ham. And then I garnish it with a sprinkling of paprika. It's a ham and egg breakfast all in one bite. Here's another couple of handy egg stuffing tips. To easily stuff the eggs, put the filling in a small plastic Ziploc bag and then cut the tip off to make an instant disposable pastry bag. Also, if you cut your boiled eggs through the middle instead of the usual end to end, they can travel with you in the egg cartons they came in. Just give the cartons a rinse first and include a toothpick in the carton for easy serving anywhere. For a copy of this recipe or a treasure trove of others, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. We'll be right back. Recently, culinary historian and historical interpreter Michael Twitty embarked on a voyage of self-discovery, traveling into the Deep South, not just in search of his ancestors, but also for rare heirloom seeds of the very plants they ate. Here, we learn how Mr. Twitty's complex identity is additionally very tied into the Judaic religion, what he calls kosher soul. So let's explore this Judaic part of your story a little further and move on to another piece of the puzzle that you call kosher soul, which also, by the way, is your Twitter handle. So what do those words really represent when you put them together?
Well, it's kind of like one way of branding one part of my identity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of like more than one person in one being, and it's a way of saying that the symbolism and meaning and deep value that Judaism and Jewish learning play in my life meets the soul element, the soul tradition, the soul people, and just the kind of the African aesthetic that I grew up with. You know, I am that guy who will walk around the streets of Manhattan with an Obama kippah, a cowrie shell ring, and a bowl of cotton in his lapel.
Okay.
And that's me. That's just me. You get what you get.
Well, I bet you stop them in their tracks.
Oh, yes. it's fun because it's living to be your authentic self.
Yes.
And so when it comes to the plate, when I was in your part of the world and I, you know, Miss Miriam covert hunted me down, you know what I noticed about her recipes?
What?
Her recipes were Southern and Jewish, but they weren't kosher soul. And that fascinated me because I swore up and down that we were going to have the same results, same answers to the same questions.
Yes.
We had the same questions, but not the same answers. And that just her fried chicken and my fried chicken weren't exactly same, so to speak. And that was really something because I thought about what is it that makes these two approaches to making Southern and Creole or whatever food kosher or fitting into the realm of Jewish food different. And that was really the exploration because I thought I knew what I was doing until I met her and said, oh, wow.
Well, last year, the time that you're referring to, you embarked on this adventure that you dubbed the Southern Discomfort Tour. Mm-hmm. And you traveled from Maryland to Louisiana searching out what, really?
My family history combined with my food roots. You know, I have had a slew of television viewing and reading where people praise the land that they come from. And I thought about something. I said, what is my land? You know, I've always talked about this stuff. But what really is my country? What is my terroir?
Yeah.
And what right do I have to it? And so I set about thinking about how do we combine these two visions. And also I just thought to myself, there's a certain element in the food of the South that is disappearing day by day, that needs to be captured, that needs to be spoken to, needs to be researched, documented. And I wanted to talk to the elders in my family, too, and see what they had to offer. So that whole journey is really about telling the story of slavery and food as a genealogical experience, as an ecological experience as well, trying to blending those two stories together and looking at the legacy. Both you and I are a product of the legacy of slavery and food in America. And we're different parts of the family tree, but we still cousins.
Well, I love the way you tie that genealogy thing in, because actually your website is called The Cooking Gene.
Yes. And I've since found out that there were more than likely more than one woman in my family who was the big house cook.
Oh, really?
And one of whom, I got to tell you this story. I got to leak this one out there. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay, so one of them, her name was Rose. And right after the Civil War, the overseer in Alabama tried to rough her up and beat her up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what she did to him?
What?
She took him in the cellar and drowned him in a barrel of molasses.
Well, that's a relative to be proud of.
Oh, she said no one's going to disrespect her. No one's going to take her out. And he hit the bottle a lot, so
yeah.
she got to claim that he hit the bottle and ended up in the molasses.
Well, Michael, one of your overriding philosophies is that racial healing can occur through the story of the African heritage in Southern food.
Mm-hmm.
Explain how that healing goes about.
You know, I'll put it like this. We were in Natchez, Mississippi, at Melrose Plantation. We had a group of people, white and black, sitting around a big old bushel or two of fresh crowd of peas, shelling peas together. And we had white kids and black kids and white elders and black elders and white adults and black adults, male and female, sitting together, shelling peas, telling each other their stories, asking questions. How do you do that recipe? How do you do that? I heard people say the words, that's the first time I've seen anything like that here in Natchez, Mississippi.
Well, it's about time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, our mutual friend, Mrs. Chase, says that the problems of the whole world could be solved over a bowl of gumbo.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I know that another one of your great passions is seed saving. You know, you talk about all the things that are endangered and that you were looking, searching for to help save and protect them. So this is an interest that you and I really shared together. And mm-hmm. one of the things that I saw mentioned in some of your writings was the white kusha. Now, down here in Louisiana, we often see again now the green and white striped kusha. Mm-hmm. How's the white one different?
Well, technically, when it comes down to the flesh of the thing, not that different. But you have to remember that different varieties came to fruition at slightly different times from each other mm-hmm. and have certain staying power and staying ability. We call that same plant potato pumpkin in other parts of the South. For example, in Maryland and Virginia, it's called potato pumpkin. But you guys have like this amazing growing season. I don't think it ever stopped.
No, pretty much not. August, I mean, it's our worst month.
Oh my God, I can't even believe it. I couldn't believe how like long it goes. But you have to remember, that's the biggest reality. I mean, I'll put it to you like this. When I was in Mobile, I had a discussion with Chef Vincent Henderson, old-time Mobilian Creole chef.
Uh-huh.
And he enlightened me to something I had never thought about as someone who is, you know, trying to rescue recipes and seeds and bring these heirlooms back into usage. And he said, you realize that there's different gumbos for each season. You realize that there's different vegetables for each season, and the way you make certain dishes depends on what's coming out of the ground, and it also depends on what other things that thing can be paired with. So there was this idea that the dish is not just there. It depends on the location of the food resources at that time and how they work together. And that's what I want to find out about.
Well, it's really exciting to learn the things that keep you ticking. And another thing that I want to be able to touch on is your role as a historical interpreter. And mm-hmm. when you do this, you actually dress in period clothes and mm-hmm. cook over open fires in the way of the ancestors. So tell us a little bit about that part of your life.
You know, that's a whole other set of community. I've been really blessed in the past couple of years to really sort of connect with African-Americans from across the country, from all the way from New York to Louisiana, over to Florida, up to Missouri, who are doing the same kind of work, who are, you know, volunteers, docents, and, you know, full-time interpreters who don the garb of enslaved people, who cook in that way, who do other crafts and other skills in that way. And it's a very strange process because, I got to tell you, being in a brick kitchen, on your feet for 12 hours, standing up, doing the course of recipes that would be required for a holiday. It boggles the mind. When I was growing up, Poppy, I heard the urban legend that if you were in the house, you had it made. I don't believe that anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's tough on your feet and your back, and your hair gets burned off your arms, and you lose eyebrows on occasion.
Yeah, if you're lucky not to burn up entirely.
Yes, exactly. And I've had both positive experiences and negative experiences. One time I was at a certain site in Virginia, which shall remain nameless. One of the docents said to me, was very frustrated because I would go through the whole, you know, 5-minute spiel that I created about what it was like to have Christmas on this particular plantation and what it meant for both communities, the white community and the black community, and in between. And the last group comes through and the woman said to me, well, you don't have to tell them the history and all that. Just tell them that you're the cook.
Ooh.
And I said, girl, you better get it back up to the big house while you still got a chance. I mean, it was so frustrating. But at the same point in time, you know, we talk about healing and going across cultural lines. You would be amazed to have so many people. They start testifying. Oh, I grew up just like that. Oh, my father used to cook with that. People of all backgrounds. And it's not just salt and pepper Southerners either. It's people from every background saying, oh, in my country or my grandfather's country, they had okra. This is what we did with it. Or, this, you know, that kind of dialogue. And, you know, kids get really excited. They get really into it. They start appreciating history, appreciating the microwave. And, you know, it's all there. It's a real opportunity to have the kind of dialogue about a very tense and intense issue in our history and our contemporary lives that we otherwise would not have.
So what's coming next in the life of Michael Twitty? What's the next big bell you're going to ring for us?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I want to continue on my genealogical path, but through my DNA. And I really want to go back to the continent. That is really my goal for the next couple of years, because I think it's time. I think it's time for me to see this continent, this mother I've been talking about. You know, I feel like an orphan. I feel like there's something I'm missing. Like, my real birth mother is out there. She's waiting for me. And I'm not a romantic about it. I know fully well that it's a place of great beauty and great turmoil, that there's a lot of issues there. But I've had 25 years, since I'm a little kid, dreaming about this and dreaming about, you know, reconnecting with this part of myself that's always been a deep thing about me. You know, when I was in Israel, by the way, Poppy, I ran into a group of Ethiopian Jewish teenagers at the Western Wall. And the most beautiful moment in my life was when I was talking with them and I had to go and I said goodbye. And they all lifted their hands in a fist.
Wow.
They said, Shalom, Achi, which means goodbye, my brother.
Oh, that's beautiful, Michael.
But I want more moments like that.
Well, I hope you'll let me say goodbye, my brother, and please come back and visit with us soon, would you?
Absolutely. Anytime.
African-American Judaic writer and culinary historian Michael Twitty. Culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's culinary heritage hero is the last of the original street vendors in New Orleans. You know our hero is coming when you hear the sound of a ship's bell ringing, accompanied by the noise of mule hooves on the streets of uptown New Orleans. Our culinary heritage hero's grandfather originally began operating the mule-drawn cart in 1915. The candy, which has always been made on the cart, came to Louisiana with our hero's Sicilian great-grandmother. Our hero's grandfather passed away in 1969, leaving New Orleans without our precious candy for 2 years. But our culinary heritage hero came home from the service and literally took the reins of the mule-drawn wagon, bringing Roman taffy candy back to the streets of the Crescent City. Our hero goes to extraordinary lengths to maintain the tradition of the mule-drawn cart, stabling the mule next to his uptown New Orleans home, and learning to repair the cart's wooden wheels himself when the city's last wheelwright died over a decade ago. That's why Ronnie Kottman, our very own Roman candy man, is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Ronnie can be found most afternoons on the streets of Uptown New Orleans, bringing sweet delight to taffy lovers everywhere. When you see him, remember to thank him for perpetuating one of our dearest culinary heritage traditions. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Roman Taffy Candy is real Louisiana Eats. we come back, we'll have a house call from my favorite MD, Dr. Gourmet. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. One of our favorite Louisiana Eats regulars is Dr. Tim Harlan, who also serves as Tulane University's School of Medicine's medical director. If you're struggling with your New Year's resolutions, never fear, Dr. Gourmet is here to help. Tim, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
It is always great to be with you, Poppy.
Well, I love it when you come see us. And, you know, Christmas and New Year's have come and gone. And most of us have been left with an extra pound or two as sort of a holiday memento. I was wondering if you could give us a good mindset for a way to go into the new year.
Well, you know, New Orleans is maybe one of the more challenging places because you kind of go from holiday to holiday. You go from Halloween to Thanksgiving to Christmas to New Year's to Carnival to Mardi Gras, you know, and it stretches on into the spring. And I think the first key for me is it's not about resolutions. You know, if you're going to make a resolution, don't make it a goal resolution. Make it an action-oriented resolution. So it shouldn't be, oh, I want to lose 20 pounds. That's been shown over and over to really be a failure. It's kind of nebulous, oh, I want to lose. Pick something that you think you can master. And for a lot of us, that could be something very simple like, I'm going to change the way I snack. Not necessarily I'm going to quit snacking, but I'm going to change the way I snack. And snacking is kind of an interesting phenomenon. People are either sweet snackers or they're salty, savory snackers. You know, most folks want one or the other.
True.
And so if you're a salty, savory snacker, most folks, you know, they turn to potato chips and crackers and pretzels. Just go for salted nuts. People will be just as satisfied with the salted nuts, and it's got that great savory flavor. I'm not a big fan of overdoing it on the salt, but if you're going to be a salty, savory snacker, nuts are your best choice. Popcorn is a really great choice. Those little 100 calorie packs of popcorn, fantastic choice. Whole grain, less salt than you think, really satisfying for the salty, savory snacker. For the sweet snacker, you know, the prototype of that is fruit. So, you know, just making those choices that it's not so much about making a resolution that I'm going to lose X number of pounds, but that I'm going to take a step, like snacking, to make that change. It's an action change.
I know that you are such a proponent of the Mediterranean style diet, and that one of the linchpins in that diet is olive oil. And I have to ask you, do you pop your popcorn with olive oil?
I do actually pop my popcorn with olive oil. I sort of pop popcorn the old-fashioned way in a pot.
Me too.
You know, the little microwave packs are great for most folks who aren't kind of hardcore foodies like you and I. The nice thing is you could also choose some great flavored oils as well. If you like really spicy food, you could use some chili oil. You could use some truffle oil, great quality olive oil. You want to be a little careful, you know, and maybe use not extra virgin olive oil because you've got a much higher chance that it's going to hit a smoke point and come out tasting a little burned.
Well, the thing that amazed me, because I married an olive oil popcorn popper, okay? And
did you seek him out? Was that like part of the ad in the newspaper? Olive oil popcorn popper?
No,
you know,
no,
seeks.
No. I specifically went looking for an oyster shucker.
Oh, an oyster shucker. Yeah. So oyster shucker seeks. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, and I got an olive oil popcorn popper in the bargain, and I couldn't get over the difference in the way that popcorn tastes.
Great flavor.
I'm a bad butter girl. That's like my worst failing, probably. And buttered popcorn, well, I can tell you, since I started popping my popcorn with olive oil, I've never put any butter on it again.
And so are you a savory, salty snacker? Yeah.
Guilty as charged.
Right, the prototype. And again, I think that for folks with New Year's resolutions, it's not about setting a goal for that resolution, but maybe an action for that resolution. Another one that I'm a big fan of is to take your own lunch. You know, just making that simple change of taking your own lunch, not eating out, can save you 250, 300, 400 calories a day.
And money, too.
Well, that's one of my favorite pitches to patients is you're looking at about $1,200 a year that you're going to spend eating out that you would spend on a PB&J. And, you know, like popcorn, not much better in the world than a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch.
So the resolution thing, if there was one single thing that you would suggest that people perhaps take on in the new year, what would that be?
One single thing that they take on in the new year. I think probably the best thing that I could say that people take on is to start planning. Most of us, we will plan everything. I could say to you, hey, you know, Poppy, what are you doing next Tuesday at 1 o'clock? And you pull out your iPhone and say, oh, you know, I got a meeting with Robert. You know, I got to do this. Or what are you doing next Friday? Oh, I've got a cooking class. You can tell me pretty much everything. I do this with patients all the time. And then I say, well, what are you having for lunch today? And people have no idea. And these are action steps. If you did nothing in the new year for your health, but sat down and figured out what you're doing for 21 meals that week, you are so far ahead of the game. And you know, okay, this is what I'm having for lunch on Tuesday. And you know you've got the ingredients in-house to take it. Make that peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Take your apple. Take your fruit. Go to town.
Okay, now we've got some double indemnity coming at us over the next few weeks because it's not just the usual two raucous weekends of course, this year, what is a very early Mardi Gras, but we've got a New Orleans-style Super Bowl right smack dab in the middle of that. What's a girl to do?
Party at the Super Bowl and party on Fat Tuesday. Again, I think one of our biggest challenges is that we think of those celebrations sometimes in New Orleans as running all together. You go from Halloween to Thanksgiving to mom's birthday to Christmas to your sister's birthday, and we focus on big celebrations. And we let them run together in such a way that we kind of end up overeating all the time. So if you're going to overeat, do it on Super Bowl Sunday. If you're going to splurge, do it on Mardi Gras. Don't necessarily do it on Lundi Gras. Don't do it the day after the Super Bowl. Don't do it the day before the Super Bowl. Pick the times that you really want to splurge, and don't beat yourself up. Enjoy those times.
Well, you are always so filled with inspiration, and it's an incredible pleasure to have you with us. So will you come back and see us again?
Absolutely,
soon?
Of course.
Dr. Gourmet, internist Jim Harlan. Super sleuth Ian McNulty is also the author of Louisiana Rambles, the definitive guide for finding off-the-beaten-path fun in our delicious state. So, Ian, what did you hunt down for us this time?
Well, today, Poppy, we're going to Lafayette, to this great new place just opened a little bit ago called the St. Street Inn. Now, the story here is part of sort of a trend that you've seen in a lot of cities where restaurants are trying to reconnect with the farms and the fishermen, that farm-to-table thing, right? Well, a lot of that production around here in South Louisiana, of course, happens in Cajun country. And this new place called St. Street Inn has made that their specialty. Interesting backstory behind this place, too. Opened by two partners who each started out in the culinary field a long time ago, then worked together as journalists, and now have made the leap back into the kitchen. So one of them is Mary Tutwiler, who's a food writer for the Independent Weekly for many years.
Oh, I know Mary. Occasionally you'd see her byline even in the Times-Picayune.
Definitely, yeah. She's contributed to a lot of places. And really, she knows Acadiana inside and out, and she's sort of documented all of these smokehouses and farms and specialty markets around the back roads. And so when she was leaving journalism, well, this is natural, right? She has all these connections. Let's make a restaurant out of them. Now, she opened it with Nathan Stubbs. He was also a reporter at the Independent, mainly, you know, working the political beat, but managed to work his interest in gas station food, which in Acadiana, of course, is a high art. So,
oh yes,
you got to admire a political beat reporter who can write about plate lunches too on his beat. Now, if you're coming here at lunch, a little more casual, and you might be having like a meat and cheese board, a crab meat salad, or something I really like, this mushroom and lentil salad they do. They use shiitakes and cremini and oyster mushrooms that all come from Bro Bridge right down the street. Dinner, though, we're talking a little bit more, a little more creative, a little bit more ambitious. Louisiana shoe pick caviar, say, you know, with sour cream, and they even put like a nice shot of vodka on the side, or something that's kind of special. These like Asian style rolls, they're almost like sushi rolls, but they're made with duck confit and they're rolled in that Cajun grain brown rice grown right out there on the prairie. The last time I went, I had this grilled duck in a sauce that had local satsuma, but also like sort of an Asian style miso. So it had this light, subtly salty, sweet flavor with that grilled duck skin. Really good.
Oh, that sounds delicious. So I'm curious, are the owners in the kitchen? Who's working in the kitchen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They have a great crew in there. You know, when you go to a great place in Lafayette, just that Cajun hospitality is very clear, really on their sleeve. Now, this is in downtown Lafayette. It's actually called the St. Street Inn, but it's not on St. Street. It's actually on Brook Avenue, which is just off of Johnston Street, sort of that main drag there. Not far from downtown, really close to the University of Louisiana Lafayette campus. Closest landmark, if you're looking for it, is the Old Time Grocery, which
yes,
a lot of people will know for its po' boys. Kind of a great campus stop off there. So a lunch place during the week, dinner Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And just really a great sort of collection of local, artisanally made products, carefully produced, harvested, and now prepared for you in this really casual, welcoming Lafayette restaurant. A real nice new find.
Well, I'm ready to go. So I just am thrilled to hear this scoop about our old friend Mary Tutwiler. That's just wonderful. Thank you, Ian.
Hey, my pleasure.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty. For this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, LA 31 brewer Carlos Knott is back with Lost Bayou Rambler Louis Michaud to kick off Mardi Gras, Cajun style.
Our Mardi Gras in our part of Louisiana is much different than over here in New Orleans, and we wanted to celebrate that ancient tradition, that Courier de Mardi Gras, with a French style beer. It's a Bière de Mars. So this beer for us is all imported French barley and hops, and it's about a 7.5% alcohol. It's a smooth beer, so it'll sneak up on you as well. We expect to see some of the riders this year fall off their horses.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightseagan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.